So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Media Podders. Just a little acoustic note for you before the show begins. We've been recording on roof terraces this summer, as you know. This week, thanks to the unique way that the Media Podcast is funded, we found ourselves literally recording on a street. So there is some background noise. And I'll use this opportunity again to say, if you'd like to pay for us to have a studio one day, do go to themediapodcast.com/donate. I'm literally begging to you from a street. Anyway, enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, Facebook launches a TV station, sort of. Netflix loses its Disney content but gains the comic book universe behind Kick-Ass and Kingsman. We discuss the importance of making your own content as a digital publisher. And in a not unrelated story, we'll discuss The Guardian losing their Football Weekly presenter and producer to a new podcast startup. Plus, we explore the publishing success of The Week Junior, a current affairs magazine for kids. The latest radio listening figures are announced. Dave and Watch have a new owner. And in the media quiz, we discover the brand's getting a TV makeover. It's all to come on today's Media Podcast. And joining me today is BuzzFeed's Louise Ridley and the creative director of Folder Media, Matt Deegan. Louise, you're in charge of special projects at BuzzFeed.
I am indeed.
Give us a special project. What are you up to?
We have just finished a huge special project, which was a week of special content last week around disability rights, which went amazingly well and was such a cool topic to focus on. We kind of make a big thing at BuzzFeed of focusing on minority groups and things, so it's disability issues are something we already cover, but we did this week-long special focus and we had a huge amount of content, kind of hard-hitting investigations and then amazing lifestyle kind of stuff. Like, we had one on very BuzzFeedy kind of piece, which was 10 things you learn if you go backpacking in a wheelchair. So we had that kind of lighter kind of thing that really gave people an insight into what was going on. We had a great investigation into how to get an NHS wheelchair and how whether you get one or not is a massive postcode lottery that got loads of pickup in The Guardian and The Mail. That kind of thing. So it's just a brilliant week and we're all very happy and continuing our coverage, really.
Well done you. Matt, you're organising the next radio conference at the moment.
Yes, that's right.
And that, to be clear, that's the next radio conference, not the next radio conference.
Yes, it probably is the next radio conference.
It probably is chronologically, yes. But it's called Next Radio.
It is. It's all about what's next, what the future of audio is, and people who work in that industry. A real kind of cross-section of speakers from Annie Mack to Nan Davis, who does the Penguin podcast for Something Else. We've got stuff on Alexa, so the BBC are doing a kind of audio drama through connected speakers, so Nikki Birch is going to be talking about that. Michelle Livesey from Key103, lots of really interesting stuff. If that tickles your fancy, next.radio has all the details.
And the tickets are relatively inexpensive for this kind of thing, right?
They are. So we've just come out of early bird, so tickets are £149 plus VAT, which compared to lots of things is relatively inexpensive.
Possibly affordable if you actually work in radio rather than run radio.
Yes,
and
that is our idea. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's start by talking not about radio, but about telly, well, online telly, because Facebook have announced the launch of Watch. This is a new feature, which is a tab on Facebook, which is essentially being billed as a rival to television. Is that true, Matt?
Yes, I think it's probably more a rival to YouTube and this idea of trying to own the amount of time people spend watching videos. So they're going for things that are more series season based, and they're encouraging creators to do that. To help it along the way, Facebook have started commissioning their own programs to try and grow their audience.
So Netflix-style programs, but on Facebook. So the idea is you're using Facebook as your second screen at the moment in front of your telly, but now you're going to be watching telly on Facebook.
Yes, perhaps a Netflix-YouTube hybrid. They are opening this up first to what they've referred to as creators, which is a very YouTube term for kind of vloggers. I think we'll also see TV production companies making short form. And we run a kids' radio station. I sent a note to our team this morning. You know, we make quite a lot of video content, a lot of education-based stuff. You know, where do those series fit in this?
But couldn't they end up cannibalising themselves, Louise? Because they have partners like BuzzFeed at the moment who make video content that sits on Facebook channels that you get to put content around. And instead they're saying, no, put your videos on this other tab where people won't see all of your branding and your furniture around it.
Yeah.
What's in it for you?
I think that's a really interesting point. If I was Facebook, from their point of view, it makes huge sense to invest in essentially creating their own content. It's kind of the big game in town. I think video is huge on Facebook and it will continue to be so, and they prioritise it in their newsfeed. So I don't think it means immediately that there'll be a cannibalization issue, but if this really takes off, then yes, absolutely, it'll be about where video sits on Facebook. And if it prioritizes its own content over publishers, then that might be a bit of an issue in terms of where publishers choose to put their stuff.
I mean, I think there is also a bit of a Facebook lie about video consumption, and I think it's
perish the thought.
I know.
You're not saying that when I flick through in 5 seconds, that's not 5 views.
Well, I think it's a 3 second watch generates a view. If you're a page owner, you can obviously dive in and look at post 30 seconds and those sorts of things. And I know that I think Box have compared a lot of video consumption that way versus telly. I think the big numbers are big, but when you really dig down in it, Facebook has a long way to go to really engage with people.
And might this finally mean the return of sound to video on Facebook? Because it was all about putting subtitles on things, wasn't it, for a long time?
That's a really interesting point. I've recently taught some students journalism, and I made a big point to say you need subtitles, anything that's possibly a social video. Imagine no one watching it with sound at all. This is very important. So that would really change a movement that we've seen completely. I think it's possible. It depends how engaging this video is and how popular it is. I think the habit of watching stuff without headphones is now pretty universal, so it depends how successful what they produce is.
One thing they've recently done, I've seen, is they have turned on sound in the Facebook app for video automatically. So where it was mute as the default before, I think the default now is sound on, and that of course helps with things like watch.
Also, there's the issue about how social you want your viewing habits to be. I mean, I still have an issue, really, with Spotify telling everyone what I'm listening to. Not because I've got any closet listens. Just because I think everyone likes to present an image of themselves that's different to what they're actually listening to on a day-to-day basis. And with Facebook video, I mean, I'm not sure I necessarily want it telling all my friends that I'm choosing to watch Celebrity Big Brother at that moment.
I mean, something I love about Netflix, which I'm a big fan of, is that you don't have people's comments all around it, and you're really zoning into a kind of private space where you're watching really good quality content and no one is bothering you with alerts all around it. And I think that would be a bit of a nightmare if there was a social element to Netflix. I would not be keen. I think that would interrupt what I would call decent experience of video.
So. Well, you have effortlessly segued us on to our next story, which is Netflix based, and the news that Disney is pulling all of their content from Netflix to set up their own platform. Now, you work in kids media, Matt, forgive me. Don't Disney already have their own streaming platform? I'm sure I remember seeing posters for it.
This has seemingly not picked up, and I think it shows they've had some trouble with it. So Disney Life is a service that runs in America and runs in the UK. It's pretty good. It has the vast majority of their material. What it doesn't have on is things that in an earlier deal they had flogged off to Netflix. And I think actually what a lot of this is tidying up their distribution. You know, it's things coming, you know, old deals that are coming to an end. They've had a little bit of trouble positioning Disney Life and getting it to have real cut through. And I think this is obviously another opportunity next year to have another go at that. I think the other interesting bit is it's Disney, it's Marvel, it's Star Wars, and that's, you know, the TV spin-offs as well as the movies. They actually have a pretty large catalogue of their own.
They're one of the big ones.
That isn't just watching old Dumbo films and that kind of stuff.
And is that why we saw a small decrease in Netflix share value on this news? Because Disney's content just is more important than other studios?
I don't know if it means that exactly, but obviously it's that caused the share drop. So I think what you see that makes this very interesting is at the same time as Disney clearly making a bit of a power grab, or whether it's tying up loose ends or not, it's making a real statement of intent. You have Netflix buying Millerworld, the big comic company, which is a really, you can look at these two giants making these two moves at the same time and see Disney becoming a bit more like Netflix, trying to get a bit more streaming. Netflix becoming a bit more like Disney, trying to realise that it needs to put even more budget into its own original stuff.
Specifically superhero properties.
Specifically superheroes, which we've seen Disney's been very successful at. Yeah.
Although they're a quirky Scottish comic book publication, right? So it's Kick-Ass and Kingsman.
Mm. Yeah, it's a Scottish guy.
It's kind of like funny British stuff, but I mean, it's not exactly world-beating Marvel-level stuff, is it?
I don't know. I mean, Netflix does make very good decisions in terms of what it commissions so far. So I think, I'm sure they know what they're doing. It's a huge deal and it's the first acquisition. So for them, clearly, it's going to lead to a huge amount of original content, which is what they really want, because they spend a lot on licensing content such as Disney's and other people's.
I mean, I think finding character IP at scale, you know, a decent amount of it, is difficult. You know, by picking up them, you know, they do pick up some good threads that can go into a variety of different things. You know, sort of Marvel Cinematic Universe has delivered huge amounts of properties, broadcast telly, VOD telly, movies. It's powering those services, so it's probably not a huge surprise that they've gone, let's find something that can help us do a bit more of that.
Oh, if they really copy Disney completely, then we might end up with a Netflix land somewhere with an Orange is the New Black ride.
It's interesting. I think that is probably what you would predict.
And okay, so the end game for Disney, that makes sense, because they are the big name in family entertainment. You know, if you've got kids, chances are you might well spend £10 a month to access all of that content, 80 years worth of classic movies and everything else. But if you're not Disney, if you're Warner Brothers or you're Fox or you're whatever, there comes a point where every studio would like their end game to be, we have our own streaming platform with all our content on it. But there must be a recognition that at some point, if you fragment it too much, people aren't prepared to pay £100 a month for 10 different streaming services and they'll just be pirating stuff again.
Though I think in America, the difference is they're already paying £100 a month for cable, which is much more expensive than what we pay for multi-channel telly kind of in the UK. And so cord cutting in the States notionally frees up a number of £10 for you to put on Amazon Prime and Netflix and other things.
So there's a limit though, isn't
there? Of course there is. And I think that's a content driven limit. So in America, CBS has their own streaming service and it's been kind of bumbling along as the sort of fourth, fifth most successful operator. But that's where the new Star Trek series is going to be. And that's going to have one viewing, one episode, the first episode, the pilot's going to be on CBS broadcast telly, and then the rest of it is going to be on CBS All Action, I think it might be called, on that system. So they're going, we want more content, more original content. We've got all of our back catalogue, and we think we can make more money on it than licensing it to Netflix.
Sticking with online content, and it's been a tumultuous week for The Guardian, who saw their most popular podcast, Football Weekly, undergo a change of presenter and producer just as the new football season is about to begin. Matt, what's happened here?
This is a good old-fashioned radio talent steal, but probably the first in the podcast world.
I think you'll find you're sitting on the former Guardian Media Talk podcast.
I thought we didn't mention that.
a land grab if ever there was one.
But Football Weekly, sort of the leading football podcast, has lost its top two people to a startup.
So this is presenter James Richardson and producer Ben Green.
Yes.
Who really are the show, basically, aren't they? That and Football News. And you can't really copyright that format, right? And they've buggered off to set up their own indie.
Yeah, so what's interesting is they're part of the new indie that's been set up. So I don't know the exact detail, but if you're going to set up a new podcast startup, stealing one of the big shows or most of the big show would be a sensible thing. I think it's one of those amusing things where the talent can move much quicker than production because the production has the notice period to run. I don't imagine The Guardian would have expected that to happen. But the big test will be, you know, brands versus presenters. You know, the Football Weekly still going to continue. We'll see in the charts how well it does.
Yes, and Louise, just in the last few days, The Telegraph has launched its own football podcast, which has gone straight towards the top of the iTunes charts. So, I mean, there are opportunities here, aren't there, to say to people who really only listen to Football Weekly, not because they like James Richardson, but because they just trusted The Guardian, to say, oh, it's fine, there are other newspapers out there that can make podcasts as well. Mm. And there's an audience there that will churn to anything.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think people are less loyal to brands and things like that, and they may go where the people are, but also we know podcasting is still expanding, which is good news for us here around the table. And I think, yeah, launching new stuff is quite an exciting thing for even for big legacy things like newspapers.
I mean, not to say that James Richardson is the Jeremy Clarkson of the online world, but there's maybe an analogy there, isn't there? The Grand Tour started, the hardcore Clarkson fans watched it. There's still an audience for Top Gear. It's not as big as it was. I mean, maybe both can continue and this isn't actually as big a deal as it seems to be at Guardian Towers, where it's really ruffled some feathers.
Yeah, I mean, I think people listen to multiple football podcasts now and they will continue to do so. I think the probably the slight difference is about your presenter passion for podcast is probably stronger than broadcast radio. And I think even for telly to a certain degree, there is something about having a thing you've chosen to listen to, you know, in your ears, you subscribe to every week that you consume. I think the other bit is that they have a relationship with that audience through social media as well. So, you know, communicating the fact of where they've gone to with a link that gets you back into it is much easier than it would have used to have been. And in the radio world, sometimes people disappear and then off for 3 months and they reappear somewhere else. Mm. And it's quite hard to communicate, oh, where have they gone? And the old show has been replaced and got a bit of a running start. I think podcasting allows this flipping around much easier. Again, we'll see channel brand versus presenter brand. I think the Telegraph one's interesting because I think the name of the new Telegraph one is quite close to what the name of the new James Richardson one's going to be. So they announced it before there was a feed, and then people, I think, have perhaps followed the Telegraph one thinking that's where they go. Oh, really? So it's okay. all a bit of a mess.
And the idea behind the new Indie is that if the audience does come to the new show, that they'll basically form a kind of football podcast network. So they haven't sort of talked about exactly what those shows will be, but they've hinted at kind of some of the minor football leagues and things like that, international football. There's an audience for all sorts of niches in football. That's a no-brainer, isn't it? Now, why hasn't that happened before? There are football podcasts for every single club in the UK, and yet, apart from a few informal arrangements, there's no big network selling advertising on it.
You could say there is. So Acast, big podcast network, have very much concentrated on signing up football podcasts, and so they collectively sell those. And I think I was talking
to someone. Have no creative control. They are selling adverts.
Yeah, but then...
And I should declare we're on Acast as well. You're listening to an Acast podcast right now. That's why occasionally you hear an inserted ad on this show, but they're not telling us what to say. There's no content curation there.
But if they wanted to say, if they wanted to run some S&P, you know, some presenter talk-ups on a product across all of those podcasts, they could do that pretty instantly. Seemingly, the relationship at the moment is such that most podcasts are happy to run the ads that are provided because they're still, even on the bigger podcast, isn't a huge volume of material to talk up. So there is notionally a football network. I've always expected there to be more niche networks around certain topics that can deliver great audiences to advertisers.
And Louise, when it comes to The Guardian as an online brand, they were pioneering in the space of podcasting when it began 12 years ago. They're part of the reason that people like me and producer Matt are involved in podcasting. That first generation of UK podcasters came on board partly thanks to The Guardian. But it seems to me the problem is they do have these legacy brands. You know, they started making shows based around their newspaper content, football, media, politics, tech, etc. And because of the success of some of those shows, they have essentially been forced to continue making those shows, which means they can't innovate. And the problem is, in the online space, you need to keep innovating. You need to keep having completely new shows and new talent. This could be an opportunity.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think if you've got a legacy brand like The Guardian, you've got a huge amount that people know about and to build on. You've got this double-edged sword where, yeah, you know, they completely, in some ways, started what has become a great podcast world. But yeah, you end up slightly trapped by what people know you for. And I think it is harder to innovate. I don't know about football podcasts so much, but more generally, I think it can become restrictive. And I think that is slightly what we're starting to see, especially with this move of the football guys off to an indie.
Yeah. That said, I think we can all agree that Chips With Everything was better when it was still called Tech Weekly and presented by me. Now, before we head into part two and some news in brief, after a year of rather complex news stories, many of you are just about to take your first holiday in 2 years. But if it's been tough for the Nationals, spare a thought for those writing the news for children. The Week Junior launched just under 2 years ago and now claims to be the fastest growing children's magazine, with over 40,000 8 to 14 year olds reading it every week. Earlier, I spoke to Felicity Capon, deputy editor of The Week Junior, about why Dennis Publishing decided to launch a print product for a generation addicted to screens.
I think the conventional wisdom when people wanted to put The Week Junior together was, this isn't going to work because kids don't want to read print, they go online for everything, and also kids don't care about the world around them. And actually, I think what's so interesting about the phenomenal growth of The Week Junior is that that's absolutely not the case. They do really like having a hard copy that comes in through the postbox with mum and dad's copy every Friday, and they are so engaged on issues that I never thought they would be, particularly Brexit. Our social media lit up with Brexit, with kids wanting to know all about it, how it was going to affect them. So it's been really fascinating in that respect. Kids really, really do care about the world around them.
Do you think it is a certain kind of kid, though? Because it does seem to me to be a certain kind of parent who would think, oh yes, well, our little darling should be reading The Week Junior so that they can learn all about the world, just like I used to read Encyclopedia Britannica in the library at school.
I think there is certainly some truth in that, but I think we are very conscious of that, and we are trying to expand ever more into schools. And we had at one point a great partnership with prisons, where we were trying to get magazines to juvenile detention centres and to more disadvantaged kids from different socioeconomic backgrounds, because I think they, if anything, they probably need it more than the kids we're reaching currently. But we're very aware of that. Yeah.
So how did you end up in children's journalism?
Well, I actually come from a more newsy writing for adults background. So before this, I was working for Newsweek magazine as a reporter and a columnist. And before that, I wrote for The Telegraph for a year and various other newspapers. So this was totally different for me coming into The Week Junior and coming into children's publishing. And I think my role was, I think they wanted me originally because I did have that newsy background, and we're trying to have a mixture on the team of experts in children's publishing and then people who also knew a little bit about what's going on in the world. So I think that's where I came in. But I think it's so different from anything I've ever written before, because everything is been turned on its head. Everything's topsy-turvy. So at one of the big newspapers, or at Newsweek, for example, if it's terrible to say, but if something awful had happened in the world, like a terrorist attack, that's when everyone's at their most busy. You know, you get maximum coverage. At The Week Junior, we all sort of sit with our head in our hands thinking, oh my God, another terrorist attack. How on earth are we going to explain this to the kids? And so it's really interesting in that sense.
So what else is different about the way editorially the magazine is put together? I mean, would you recognise, coming from Newsweek, the processes that are in place to decide what's an issue?
I think one of the most interesting things is that every time there is some good news, we all sort of do a collective victory dance. If we have a Monday morning meeting where elephants are no longer endangered, or we found some new scientific cure, we all sort of weep with happiness. Whereas, you know, there was no end of bad news at Newsweek or at The Telegraph or something, and if anything, that was, you know, you can never have too much of
bad
it. Whereas,
sells, yeah.
Exactly, whereas The Week Junior, we are always very conscious of trying to get a good balance on the pages. So if we do have to lead with, you know, the attacks in Manchester or Grenfell, we're very conscious to make sure that the rest of the magazine has enough uplifting and inspiring and sometimes downright silly stories that aren't going to put kids completely off current affairs and politics.
Understood, but is there any debate about whether or not Grenfell should be the lead, or is it always, you know, if there's a big story like that, there's no questions, or do you sometimes think this is just too bleak?
We never want to patronise our readers by just taking something out. So there was no question that Manchester would be our cover story.
The terror attack.
I mean, it was kids firstly, so they were all talking about it. And also it was Ariana Grande. Grenfell was, you know, such a huge story. There's no way we would just sort of sense the news and say this didn't happen. The world's a lovely place. There was no question about that, really. I think sometimes it's more about how we write about it and what we want to include or what we want to focus on. You know, the response to the emergency services, we might go more for that than a man wielding a knife has attacked all these people and there's blood everywhere. I think obviously things like sex abuse, we wouldn't go anywhere near it, actually, because so many of our readers won't even know what sex is. And I think if the first thing they read is it's this terrible, scary thing, that's not what we want to do.
How do you explain Donald Trump?
Donald Trump's a really interesting one. I think that's a good example, actually, of when all the issues about his treatment towards women and the whole pussy grabbing thing came about. That was a really interesting one, because we had to address that in some way. There were so many things that we couldn't actually say, but I think for that we use something like, you know, he's been disrespectful to women, or he said disrespectful comments to women, without going into all the details.
But the problem is, you know, from that point of view, there's not a happy ending, is there? You know, he said disrespectful things to women, and he's the most powerful man in the world, and America voted for him. How do you sell that?
Well, you know, but this is democracy. They need to know that. I think we're not trying to sort of whitewash the world and make it this wonderful My Little Pony place. You know, there is this man who said these terrible things and is now one of the most powerful people in the world. And that is an uncomfortable reality of our time. But actually, the point is that we are bringing up the next generation of statesmen and politicians and scientists, and they need to, I think it's actually important that they see all the unfair things and the injustices, because hopefully, that sounds very idealistic, but they're the ones who are going to do something about it and make a better stab of it than we are. So, you know, as long as we keep a balance of uplifting and inspiring stuff, yeah, they do need to know the not so great things about the world as well. I think also we have to be careful with Trump, that we are and everything we cover, we're as balanced as we possibly are. We don't have an agenda, and we try very much to say the facts, here's what's going on, but we're actually going to, you know, let you make up your mind about what you think about Donald Trump.
And as a journalist, just give us some insight into how to write for children. So what is the thing, you know, can you share any tips about writing an article that will make it work?
Headlines, I mean, again, like I was saying earlier, it's sort of topsy-turvy. You're avoiding sensationalism. You don't want some flashy headline. You want just the summing up of the story in the title. So you're going for far more sort of, I mean, they're still exciting, but nothing that's too sensationist. And then it's just about being very calm and neutral and sort of explaining the facts. Everything has to be explained. You wouldn't believe the amount of terms that you write a sentence and you think, oh, I've got to explain that word, and then you write another one, I've got to explain that word.
If I might just interject as well, a personal speculation as to your success, I think it might be that there's no specific gender that the Week Junior appears to be aimed at. And that's the thing when you're buying, you know, print media for children, isn't it? It's pretty clear, like, this is the boys' mag because it's got space on the front, and this is the girls' mag because it's got My Little Pony on the front. And, you know, current generation of parents are fed up with that. They don't necessarily want gendered media.
I think also current generation of kids have cottoned onto that, and I think that's just sort of been and gone now. I don't think you can just say space and dinosaurs is for boys and pretty dolls are for girls. I think that's just so old hat that it just won't wash.
But what's great about your magazine, you get both.
Yeah,
the story about space and ponies.
Exactly. And I don't think there's anything to suggest that boys are turning to science and tech and girls are turning to anything else. I think it is a magazine that speaks to boys and girls. And we've certainly, from our subscription and our feedback, we know that we're reaching both genders equally.
Felicity Capon. Louise, does this surprise you, the success of The Week Junior?
It doesn't, and I think several things that Felicity said there really struck a chord with me. The first was that when they set up The Week Junior, they had people telling them, kind of sceptics telling them, that children aren't interested in news, they're not interested in the world around them. And that really echoes something I get at BuzzFeed a lot if I do sort of panel talks or whatever. It's, oh, young people aren't interested in news. And this is a really common and often repeated mistake, that people assume that perhaps because young people aren't interested in the old news brands, or they don't want to receive news in the same way, that they're not interested at all. And it's evidently completely untrue.
I mean, it shows, doesn't it, that the formula, Matt, when you're trying to sell current affairs to children, is not to make them think, take your medicine, but to make them actually genuinely curious about what they're reading, and they naturally will want to educate themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, for Fun Kids, we do quite a lot of in-school work, and you know, if you think of an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, what they're exposed to every day across media and at school, it's a huge amount of information on topics and what they get from watching EastEnders or Doctor Who or Hacker on CBBC. You know, it's a huge amount of different things. And of course, they're interested in it if you find great ways to talk about it. And I think what The Week Junior has done, but also what kind of First News has done, is if you package it correctly and you understand your audience, then you'll do well.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Time for some news in brief now. Louise Ridley and Matt Deacon are still with me. Let's start with the latest listening figures, the Rajars, for the radio industry. Matt, Mr. Rajar Deacon.
I know how much half your audience enjoy this.
As much as that. I'm not sure we've got our own survey. Take us through your key findings in a way that will excite and entertain those who aren't interested in the radio industry but need the key findings for their media work. A dumpster has just driven past. I don't know if that's a metaphor.
So good news for lots of people. So best news, more people are listening to the radio. That's partly because there are more people in the country. Hooray for population growth.
And that includes digital radio, right? More digital radio listening than ever before.
Yeah, so the big number we look at for digital radio listening is share. So this is volume consumed, because at the point in which we hit 50% is when the government will start to look at whether they will implement some changes to perhaps turn off some analogue radio services.
Never gonna happen,
and what we've seen
we're
for...
We're all going to be dead.
And what we've seen for digital is that's reached an all-time high of 48.7%. Mm. So it is very close to that magic 50% number. The other thing for DAB, which is the vast majority of digital listening still, over half the country listen to some form of DAB digital radio each week. Internet growth's good, but still is only 8.8% of all radio listening. So I think people always assume that everyone listens to radio on the internet, but it's still relatively low. Looking at stations, Radio 1, which had a horrific book last quarter, is back up, which is good. Good reach, good hours. Still 15 to 24 is a little bit wobbly for them. They always say, don't worry, people watch our YouTube videos, so it's okay, honest. That's true. However, Capital, when I looked at the Capital network, it is closing in on the amount of 15-24s that Radio 1 have. So, you know, people, you know, kids and young people are listening to the radio. They're just happening to listen to some other radio stations.
Which is good news for them, considering the balls up they had around their breakfast show, right? I mean, that's been pretty confusing, who's hosting the Capital breakfast show. Which used to be quite a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you talk to younger audiences, and Roman, who's now the new presenter...
Sorry, Roman.
And seemingly...
Big fan here.
Has seemingly settled in really well, and that's still the biggest London breakfast show, biggest commercial radio London breakfast show. So they're doing something right. I mean, Capital, generally... Really good book. Network's doing well. KISS also doing well, but sadly still kind of trails Capital. The other station doing well in London, LBC, had a great book. And there is a question, you know, there's been a lot of politics news. I think LBC has really been a big part of that story over the last couple of years, and I think it's perhaps consolidated that audience. You know, they're the biggest commercial radio station in London by share. The true biggest radio station in London is Radio 4, which, you know, a lot of people in London regard as a local radio station anyway. So I think there is something interesting. Perhaps LBC and Radio 4 are doing well off the back of what people in the capital are interested in.
Well, and also the tumultuous news we've had over the last 2 years. I mean, you know, LBC are doing well, but, you know, the news has been compelling, hasn't it? And LBC is essentially 24 hours Brexit and Trump.
It has, but I think they've positioned themselves to do well out of Brexit and Trump and delivering a rolling version of that.
So how does it compare against Five Live, Talk Radio?
So Five Live and Talk Sport have had pretty bad books if you look year on year. Now, they haven't had a big football event, which we had last year. And also, I think what they're finding kind of is legacy broadcasters. I think for Five Live, which is predominantly news, you know, people think of it as a sports channel, but it's predominantly news, have had some of their special sauce taken away by LBC's growth, being an accessible news outfit, which is what their thing used to be. And also probably Radio 4 being a little bit more accessible than it has been in the past. So they're difficult for them to find a way.
Excellent. Thank you for your analysis, as ever. Louise, the big story here as well is that commercial radio really is competing with the BBC now. And that has come about thanks to these consolidated brands, many of which Matt just checked off there. Do you miss radio stations being local, being part of the community, having their own identity? Or do you think it's a good thing for listeners that you can listen to Capital in Wales and Heart in Cambridge?
I think there's such a strong argument on both sides of that. I used to work for a great local radio station called Radio Jackie in southwest London,
which
I loved. So working there was great.
Do they not exist anymore?
No, they do. They do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think going strong. I think it's a tough shout. I am kind of a believer in, if people are being provided with good entertaining radio, then wherever it comes from, that is how the market moves, which is probably a bit of a harsh reality. But I know, Matt, in some of your writing, you talked about the Heart 80s, is that right? Which is doing really well, which is a sort of really simple format, giving people this underserved 80s music that everyone loves, and it's Heart using its brand. And that's the kind of success that people might not get that excited about, but it is a success and it's great. You know, it's great to give people something they want. And I think there's a danger of over analysing these things. And I find radio such an enjoyable medium that it's important to celebrate everyone getting something they want and getting it easily, really.
I mean, I think one of the big shifts for older format radio or local radio, that was at a time, I think, even in the up to the 90s, where no digital radio, no internet, no broadband, and local radio stations on those FM frequencies did very well because there wasn't anything else to listen to. And it's easy to jump to the assumption that that's because they did a really great job. And I think they did do good jobs, but maybe it was also because they were a monopoly provider of that platform. And suddenly when you open it up and you provide more choice to people, you see that it's like Heart 80s, 840,000 reach on its first book. You know, that's a phenomenal market that's just appeared overnight, the consuming that radio station. Now, that doesn't mean other stations are rubbish, but it does say that there was an underserved market that now fits.
And a success of branding, because Absolutely. Heart 80s, you know what that means. Jack FM have been doing that for, 5 years anyway?
Yes.
But harder to understand what it means.
Absolutely. And that's his history, and that's having... You've done the same thing for a long time. I think Heart's probably like 95, I think, its first appearance on the radio dial. But also, it's a really good product. I mean, it's a really slick, well-made, well-programmed product. The main service, as well as what they've done with 80s.
Okay, let's talk about the Sunday Times. Last week, they fired Kevin Myers, the columnist whose anti-Semitic comments found their way into the Irish edition of the paper. Louise, recap what happened here for those who missed it.
So this was a column recently from Kevin Myers, who's a journalist I hadn't heard of, and I think a lot of other journalists hadn't heard of, though he obviously writes for the Sunday Times Irish version.
So. He appears to be the sort of Jan Moyer of Ireland.
Yes, I think so. So clearly a controversial columnist, and his history is of writing many, many deliberately, I would say, provocative columns. Or they've been published because the publisher clearly knows they're deliberately provocative. He published a piece about the BBC gender salary gap, which has been much discussed, and essentially said several what I would say are definitely sexist things about women, and said what were accused to be anti-Semitic things about two female presenters who also happen to be Jewish, and kind of linked that to why they might be earning a lot more.
Yeah, so what he did is he said, if you look at the highest earning women, having slagged off women for 500 words, he said, then said, if you look at the highest earning women, Claudia Winkleman and Vanessa Feltz, and the comment was something like, you'll note that they're both Jews, a population not unknown for haggling for a better salary.
Yeah, it lent on lots of
proper Victorian anti-Semitism. Yeah.
So
how did that get into the paper?
Well, this is the question that you know, some people have touched on but isn't quite looked at enough. So what happened to him is he did get fired. Everyone did get outraged about this. But he said himself that this column he wrote would have gone through 5 or 6 people who would have approved it going in the paper. And the sort of my reaction and a lot of my fellow colleagues' reaction to see this sort of outrage going on Twitter was just this slight eye roll, like another incident where someone's written an outrageous column. Clearly their whole job, they've been hired to be provocative, and the paper has gone too far in deciding that was okay and perhaps slightly lost perspective because they constantly publish these controversial columns by him, so that it's not a case of is this column okay? He's always controversial. How far within the bracket of controversial? You already put yourself in a very controversial space, so they've clearly made an error of judgment there. It's just a shame that that could happen, and I think it's just a bit of a bind that we find ourselves in, because I believe in free speech and people can express opinions, but when you get columnists like him and like Katie Hopkins, who are hired to upset people to some extent, I would judge, it just puts you in a really problematic space where you push further and further and further. And it's, I've got to say, it's always or often old white men who are being paid to do this, and you think, where are the young non-white women getting to voice their really outrageous opinions? It's a particular kind of journalist who often gets paid to have that platform, and it's a bit of a shame, really.
And Matt, what does this say about the way that the regional versions of the Sunday Times in this instance, but actually any kind of national brand, operates? Because actually, in internet terms, they all appear at thetimes.co.uk.
Yes.
So you could say they are the same publication, even though they were strange to point out they're not.
Well, as the Mail did. How can you possibly think we're Mail Online? Because that's your website, I think. But also, similar issue with Kelvin. And his unacceptable comments. I mean, I imagine from a production point of view, whoever is there to review the material, as you were saying, goes, this is the person we have to say the crazy things. Yep, they said some more crazy things, right, copy and paste, right, next thing I've got to do before the paper goes to bed. It's that, isn't it?
So they get does it more, basically, from being in that position. Mm.
And may I just say, for the record, when it comes to my salary for the media podcast, my Judaism has failed me. Here's a story that you may have missed. Discovery, fronted by Murdoch nemesis John Malone, has just picked up 50% of Scripps, the company that runs Dave and Watch and the other UK TV channels. So, Matt, that now puts Discovery in bed with BBC Worldwide.
Yes.
So who sold off their shares? What does all this mean?
So Scripps had 50% of UK TV, with the BBC having 50%.
And so that's BBC Worldwide.
BBC Worldwide.
Yeah.
So all of Scripps has been acquired, or was about to be acquired by Discovery. Therefore, they pick up their UK holdings, which includes UK TV. I mean, UK TV, very, very successful operation, makes a lot of money for everybody. I don't think Scripps particularly are a noisy media operator, particularly. You know, they don't see them, the head of Scripps doing the McTaggart lecture or anything like that, do you? Discovery are doing more in Europe. You know, they acquired Eurosport last year, I think. They've got the European Olympic rights in most of the territory. They've even subbed some of that back from the BBC, because the BBC have a bit more Olympics to come. So they are a big and growing European player. They're always potentially in the frame for an ITV acquisition. Mm. I think they're in the frame for the Channel 5 acquisition before Viacom got it. So they're definitely a bigger player in the market. I think there was some talk that when Scripps took 50%, or bought out the last shareholders of UK TV, they asked the BBC, BBC Worldwide, whether they could take the lot. And BBC Worldwide were keen to keep hold of their half. I'm sure Discovery would like it all, because I think, in effect, it's the biggest advertiser after ITV, or it's up there kind of with Sky and Channel 4. So it's one of the big players now.
Is there still heritage and credibility for a brand like Discovery basically being able to say, look, we broadcast, I don't know, Fawlty Towers and Only Fools and Horses and these classic BBC comedies? Does that matter anymore? Because Discovery are a huge company. They see themselves as one of the great programme makers of the world. So is there still something special in being able to broadcast BBC content?
I think broadcasting popular shows that have strong awareness is a good thing if you're trying to be a multi-channel network. And you know, these well-funded BBC programmes are a quick shortcut to doing that. Saying that, though, UK TV have had a lot of success with Dave, with its new programming.
Yeah, or as I call it, the Dara O'Brien slate.
Yes, and I think they've managed to build some of that success off the back of, obviously, the audiences that reruns of Top Gear have given them, and the personality that curating those shows have given them to launch this new original content. I think what you also find, and I think they found it with Channel 5 and Viacom, is the Channel 5 output can be expanded because of links with other properties within that company. And I think, you know, Discovery Communications as an evil corporate entity, one thing, versus the Discovery Channel, Shark Week, etc., are probably kind of two separate things to think about. But they Discovery and now Scripps have a large number of different channel brands with a large bits of programming that they can put on the different channels too.
Okay, and sticking with relatively undercovered outposts of the BBC, let's talk about the World Service, because the fallout from the BBC salary revelations last month continue unabated, and now, Louise, the World Service are up in arms. Why?
They are indeed. There was meant to be a report into the salary gap, which many people speculate or know perhaps inside is very large between the World Service and the BBC and then Network News. This report was meant to be out in the spring, and it's been delayed for whatever reason, which is causing a lot of angst. It's been promised that it will be out soon. From a Guardian report that I read, there was sort of sources saying that they don't know of any BBC World Service presenters who earn more than £50,000 a year. Yet we know from recent revelations that people like Hugh Edwards are earning about £600,000 at the news section of the programme, which is obviously a pretty insane gap. The World Service is meant to be a real jewel in the crown. It reaches millions of people. And I think there was a Freedom of Information request earlier this year which showed that the average senior broadcast journalist gets 10% less than the average news network journalist. So this is a pretty significant gap, and I think there's all reason to be slightly up in arms. So hopefully that report will come out and changes may be made.
But those changes, I guess, could end up with us all paying more from the licence fee, and of course most people in Britain aren't watching the World Service. So I mean, there is an argument that, you know, things are right as they are.
Sure. I mean, the reason that I would imagine this has happened was historically World Service was run very separately from the BBC, you know, in a different building by a different team, and there wasn't so much crossover with Network News and World Service operations. So I think they have travelled their own route. I think the other thing is some of these presenters are on shows that, you know, tens of millions of people listen to and are huge deals in different parts of the world. But, you know, it's not front of mind, is it? And the people who actually hold the big purse strings don't consume it, don't really think about that and understand how that works. So, again, follows its own trail.
OK, we're nearly done, but there is just time for our media quiz. This week, it is entitled Regeneration. As the dust settles on the revelation that the new Doctor Who has no male genitalia, your task this week is to guess what these popular media properties have regenerated into. It's the best of three. Buzz in with your name. So, Louise, you will say...
Louise.
And Matt, you will say...
Matt.
The winner is Mel and Sue. The loser, Noel Fielding. Bit harsh. Here we go with regeneration number one. BBC Radio 4's Front Row.
Louise. I believe this is the fact that Giles Corran will be fronting a TV version of,
yes,
Front Row on BBC Two.
Yes, which sounds a bit like the culture show that they axed 5 years ago.
Yeah, interestingly so. So I think, you know, it's a pretty, I guess, I suppose it's a comfortable and safe kind of idea, but it's interesting that they scrapped a similar sort of idea.
Kind of annoying, though, isn't it, Matt, that when they take a radio title and move it to telly, a radio title with really good presenters, many of whom have TV experience... Mm. They're replacing the presenters with Giles Corran, Amal Rajan, Nikki Bedi. All good presenters, but, I mean, what was wrong with the Radio 4 presenters?
Also, I read they're going to work incredibly closely with the Front Row team, but I think the programme's being made by BBC Scotland. Excellent.
To be fair, the culture show at which I used to work was also made by BBC Scotland as a co-production with the team at TV Centre, and we had a weekly conference call, so I think you'll find that is working very closely. Right, who am I regenerating as now? I am former Downing Street Chief of Staff, Nick Timothy.
Louise,
for the win.
So Nick Timothy, who left as one of the two main advisers to Theresa May in June after the shambolic snap election.
Left is a useful word in that sense.
Left, yes, yeah. Left. Very correct here. Has been, or is being regenerated into a columnist,
yes,
for The Sun and also The Telegraph, which was quite a surprise move because it came very soon and seems that those Tory-supporting papers have forgotten that he was responsible for the policy of the shambolic general election and apparently wrote the manifesto and came up with the dementia tax. So he is not a friend to the people who wanted Theresa May to get a bigger majority. So it's very interesting to see. I think he's already written a piece kind of towing a why we got it wrong, very open kind of line about that. But it's pretty interesting recruitment, I'd say.
Okay. Well, Louise has already won, but we're all on the edge of our seats to see whether Matt can come in with a point here. Radio 1's Big Weekend. Who am I regenerating
as?
Matt.
I think this is going to be the biggest, BBC's biggest weekend.
Correct.
Which I hope they don't keep as a name because it's dreadful.
Working title.
So, because there's no Glastonbury, or that's the hook anyway, because there's no Glastonbury, Radio 1, Radio 2, The other music networks are going to have a weekend of activity across Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and England to reflect the networks and to fill that Glastonbury-sized gap.
Good idea.
I'm torn. The BBC do things very well. This is a nice
it'll
focus.
It'll rate, won't it?
It will rate, and it will be a good way to tell people about what's on these radio stations, and I like that as from a radio programmer. From the commercial side of me, I feel we're not underserved by music events, commercial music events, and...
Yeah, why not just Green Latitude instead?
Yeah, I imagine if I was the producer of an event at a similar time in a similar place, the BBC popping up and doing a very good job might annoy me slightly.
Yeah. That is it for our show for today. My thanks to Louise Ridley, Matt Deegan and Felicity Capon. Catch up with our previous episodes and get the latest episodes as soon as they're released by subscribing for free at our website, themediapodcast.com. Today's show is dedicated once again to Simon Colum, a musician and accompanist for The X Factor. Thank you for your continuing support, Simon. If you would like to keep us on the air, like Simon, you can get a dedication twice. Go to themediapodcast.com/donate. Give generously. As you can see, we will not turn away your money. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill. The Media Podcast is a PPM production. And until next time, in Edinburgh, bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.